City Talk 105.9 official podcasts. Online at citytalk.fm. Downtown Liverpool in business with Frank McKenna. City Talk 105.9.
Hello and welcome to City Talks Business with me, Frank McKenna. I'm the chairman of the Independent Private Sector Lobby Group and Business Networking Club, Downtown Liverpool in Business. And every Sunday I'll be taking a look at some of the week's big business stories and talking to some key personalities, decision makers and entrepreneurs who work in and influence Liverpool and the wider Northwest region. This week we're looking at the issue of marketing and PR. Business guru Robert Craven will be talking to us about his latest book, Bright Marketing. And I'm joined in the studio by website and online expert Brian Adams of PH Creative and the managing director of leading Liverpool public relations agency, Paver Smith, Dougal Paver. Also with us today is Paul Rice of the Liverpool Commercial District Partnership. Paul is also involved in Liverpool Football Club pressure group, The Spirit of Shankly. But first to Robert Craven, one of the UK's leading authorities on marketing and entrepreneurship and the chief executive of the Directors Centre. Robert, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's a pleasure to be here.
I heard you speak at a conference in Lancashire a few weeks ago, and you were telling delegates in a pretty blunt but effective way to forget the recession and just get on with things. Can positive thinking get businesses through the sort of economic downturn we've experienced over the past few months?
I don't think it's just about positive thinking, because if you bang your thumb with a hammer, it hurts, and it doesn't matter how much positive thinking you put to it, the thing actually hurts. But I think a positive attitude, and I guess one of the things I'm talking about is there seems to be a difference between the inspirational, motivated entrepreneur and what I call a sort of poor me SME, someone who feels pity, someone who thinks the government owes them a living, someone who thinks that there should be an enterprise agency or a business link and they should sort themselves out, and someone who becomes ultimately a victim rather than someone being in control of their destiny.
Mm. What was interesting for me about your contribution at the conference was we broke into workshops and I was actually facilitating a group of about 12 people. And I said to them, what did you think of the contribution from Robert? And they were all absolutely fantastic, superb. And then spent the next half hour actually blaming the government, the banks, Business Link and every other agency under the sun for their businesses not doing quite as well as they may. It's a message that's difficult for people to actually take on board, isn't it?
I think there's two conflicting messages going out all the time. And one of them is, you're not alone, we're here to help. And the other one is we probably can't provide what you want. And I think it's really confusing. If you're standing on the high street, everyone's saying we can help you, but they only want to help you in a certain way according to their remit, which is fine. But when I set up my first business when I was 21, I had this great idea. I was going to do it. Nothing was going to stop me. Everything was too bureaucratic or paper-bound. So I just got on and did it myself. Mm. And I think that's often the attitude you need, rather than becoming dependent. And this whole, it's like a teacher and a child, or a parent and a child. And maybe it's a bigger general political statement that we feel we're owed something by them, whoever they are, whereas I think we have to go out and do our own thing.
Do you think the state, the government, get too involved in business and business support these days then?
I think there's a political imperative to be involved. There's 4 million independent businesses in the UK, and only a foolish political party would ignore 4 million votes plus another 3 or 4 employees for each of those. So there's something like 10 or 12 million votes there. So you'd be foolish to ignore it. But on the other hand, the rational solution to business support is politically unacceptable, and that is that you ignore startups because they're probably not going to succeed. So that's like a lottery. Mm. And if you were a betting man and you went to the horse race, and I said to you, you can bet before the horses start the race, or you can bet when they're 100 yards from the line, which one would you rather bet? Mm. And the answer is always we'd rather bet when they're 100 yards from the finishing line. Yeah. And that's where, if you want the biggest bang for your buck, those businesses which are growing and successful are the ones that need the investment because they're creating most of the jobs. Unfortunately, they only represent 5 or 10% of the small business stock. Mm. So it's politically unacceptable to just invest in growing successful businesses. But if we're talking economics, that's kind of where the investment should go.
Do you think now is a good time to start your own business? You talk about new starts. People will probably look at the economic climate at the moment and think it's the last thing they should be doing. What's your thoughts on that?
I think it's a brilliant time, and that's not because I have been taking my happy pills. I think it's a brilliant time because there's been a shakeout in nearly every industry where the weaker people are no longer able to continue trading. That means a couple of things. That means that in some senses, the competition isn't quite so severe. It also means if you're starting up, there's office space, there's computers, there's people, there's secretaries, there's lots of resource around relatively cheaply. I think also what's different with this recession is so much stuff is available virtually free, whether that's business advice, setting up a website, marketing campaigns, Facebook, Twitter, whatever it is. So the opportunity to communicate is much better. And I think that at the same time, the customer is really, really fed up. We're all fed up with signing in for insurance like I did this morning on a computer system which clearly doesn't work. We're fed up with a total lack of customer service. We're fed up of everything being sold on price when in fact what we want is a nicer customer experience or some kind of customer experience. So I think if you've got the energy and you've got the oomph and you've got the bottle and you've got a great idea and people seem to want it, then go for it.
And you were contending at the conference that traditional marketing doesn't work. So in terms of a new business startup, or indeed, I mean, the point you were making really was even existing businesses should be renewing and modernising their marketing strategies. What sort of area do you think that businesses need to be looking if they're to, if you like, stand out from the crowd?
Well, I think there's been a shift of power from the big businesses to the customer. So now the customer talks, and the customer talks to each other, and they can create incredible pressure on the big boys. For instance, if you look at Facebook, a wall has been set up campaigning against the BBC closing Radio 6. Mm. And I would not be surprised if Radio 6 stays open because of that pressure. HSBC's had the same problem. They've tried to put in a graduate loan fee, which had previously not been there. And within 2 weeks of this happening, Facebook had 6,000 members complaining about HSBC and telling people to boycott them. So the power has changed from large organizations, interruption marketing, they interrupt you, they tell you what you need to buy, to customers talking to each other. On top of that, people no longer believe adverts. We don't believe that companies tell the truth in adverts. So what we do believe is word of mouth. If I come up to Liverpool and I want an accountant, I'll ask you. I'll say, who do you recommend I should be using? I'm not going to go to the yellow pages. I'm not going to wait for the adverts to come in. So it's far more now about working the word of mouth system, whatever that is for your business, and it varies according to your business, than it is just by buying space in the local evening paper, buying space on the radio station, buying space. You can't just buy sales now. What you need to do is you need to have a dialogue, and people need to feel that you're human, and then they buy from you.
I mean, the exception to that rule, obviously, is if you advertise on City Talk 105.9, your sales go through the roof. But I take the point that you make.
I'm talking in general terms. But I think there has been more pressure on the traditional marketing tools because they're more expensive. I can on Twitter, I can access 1,000, 2,000 people who know who I am and sell to them. And I think what was going on is in the old days, the notion was you just sent out your message. So if you imagine there's three sets of people. There are strangers who've never met you before, and that's who your advert tends to go to. Then there are your friends, people who know your business, who maybe have not bought from you. And then there are your lovers, you know, the people who actually have bought from you. The old school idea was you spend 80% of your time selling to strangers, which is nonsense because they don't know who you are. And you spend maybe 15% of your time selling to your friends, and you spend maybe 5% of time selling to your lovers, existing customers. I think that's entirely the wrong way around. I think you should spend virtually all your time getting your ambassadors, your raving fans, the people who really like you, to help you grow your business, rather than hoping that the more transmission-based approach will actually work. So it's more and more now about relationships. And obviously, you know, people need to know who you are before they have the relationship, and that's obviously where radio or television advertising comes in. But I think more and more the goal is relationships rather than just transmission.
I've got Dougal Paver here from Liverpool PR agency Paver Smith. Just wants to have a word with you, Dougal.
Sure.
Morning, Robert.
Good morning.
I agree with you on the issue of your first contention about how entrepreneurs with the right mindset can go and carve out distinctive positions in markets, and that success often is a state of mind and a focus, really. In my experience, most marketplaces are so fragmented relative to the size of any given operator that the scope for rapid organic growth, if they get their propositions right, is tremendous.
Yeah.
You know, there are very, very few sectors where there are so few suppliers that you can't make that happen.
Yeah.
So if you're in the business of building nuclear submarines, there ain't that many competitors. But if you're in the business, as I am, of providing PR advice, for example, it's a £900 million a year market in the UK, and there must be 25,000 suppliers and the customers to go with that supply base. So if you can get your proposition right and your energy and your enthusiasm and everything else that you need to do, then I agree with you. I think there's no reason why good businesses can't thrive and continue to grow. And we see the victim culture quite a bit across the piece here. I think you're spot on there.
Great, great, good. And I think also it's about something you were just saying there is more and more now, it's not about spending big bucks on marketing. It's actually spending the time, which may equal money, but the time getting the proposition sorted out so that you don't present yourself just as a me too, the same as everyone else. You know, the big question is always, you know, why should people bother to buy from you? What makes you different from the rest? Yeah. And if people say, oh, I'm an accountant, I'm like every other accountant, I can't think of a single reason why people should bother to buy from you. So it's about finding that sweet spot, finding that hook, finding the hurt that the customer has that you're able to sort out.
Yep.
Brian Adams from PH Creative. Brian, obviously you have been advising people how to get involved in improving their online presence in particular.
Yeah, that's right.
You noticed a significant shift in the way people are looking to market and advertise their products these days?
Yeah, absolutely. And I think just picking up on one of the first points, the R word, the recession, I think it definitely creates opportunity, and those businesses with the mindset to get out there and market themselves more and engage people will hail the pillars of marketing. Well, essentially now there's just more pillars out there available, and how you use them means you've got a much wider reach and you can be more effective with how you deliver a message. But it's definitely not interruption marketing that's growing businesses these days, to pick up on another point of Robert's. It's conversation, it's definitely engagement, and it's two-way communication. It's not so much what a business is selling, it's what people want to buy. And you know, you're not going to take the advice of a car salesman if you want to buy a new car. You will take the advice of your friends, and you know, and when you take that online, that's where social media can really help boost your business. And and it just goes to show that there's different opportunities out there, there's different ways of reaching your target audience, and it's about businesses being open-minded and embracing those opportunities.
So Robert, would you say it's the internet that has actually changed the whole landscape of advertising and marketing then? Is it just the internet?
I think the internet is the platform that's enabled much faster communication and make everything global. And I think the internet, ironically, provided the big businesses with this promise of being able to put the customer in charge, you know, the idea that the customer's in charge. Unfortunately, while the idea, let's put the customer in charge, is a great one because then the customer can choose what they want, if you take it to its logical extension, the customer actually ends up being a DIY job all the time, like IKEA. So while the big businesses wanted the internet to do all their sales for them, actually the customer is angry. The customer's really angry and really fed up with everything being done on price and not on quality. And what the customer wants is they want what it says on the tin, and they want it to be easy, and they want it to be friendly, and they probably want to buy something that they know is good because their friends or colleagues have recommended it. So the internet has worked as a platform for sure.
Once again, Robert, do you think that presents more opportunities for business to take advantage of those things? Essentially, I think I've got one of the easiest jobs in marketing because all I do is put my customers in front of people who are already looking for their products and service. But I think instead of trying to sell to people these days now, I talk about immediate pain. You know, think about what your customers are really, really looking for and begin relationships based on value and trust and credibility. And, you know, that's how you're going to build brands online because there's no hiding places, is there?
There's no hiding place. Also, in the old world, you just put out your message and hope the right person would find it. But now, if it's something like Google AdWords, you can actually you know, tap in the precise thing, like can't find a photocopier for under £50 in blue. And if your Google AdWords, you know, phrase is the same, you'll find someone who's actually looking for the very thing that you're selling. Mm-hmm. And so yes, it's made it easier. It's increased expectations, which I think is great, because that means that those who can't hit the expectations fail, which means that those who can succeed. Decisions are made faster. The customer can be more choosy if they can be bothered, but they're still essentially cash rich and time poor. So it's still about relationship, it's still about brand, it's still about being in front of them when they want to make the purchase.
Robert, Dougal here again. You made a really interesting point about how many big businesses have failed to genuinely put customers in charge online and let them drive the sale process and the product specification. And there's a really good exception to that rule, of course, which is Dell Computers.
Yeah.
And they were the first to cotton on to this. And of course, one of the things that they found was that in allowing customers to specify their products, whilst giving them access to experts at the end of the phone line as well, that people specify for themselves far more expensive laptops and PCs.
Yeah.
And the average sale value shot through the roof just by dint of putting them in charge of the specification process.
Yeah.
And it's amazing that so few of Dell's competitors have copied this. Given how successful it's been for them.
Absolutely. $13 million last year they made just with social media. And they were actually the first on Twitter to sell $1 million of old stock in 1 month just using Twitter alone. I mean, it's incredible, isn't it? Mm.
Robert, can I just turn to the issue of customers? You mentioned there that people are far more discerning now in terms of what they buy. But I thought also one of the more controversial statements that you made a few weeks back was that firstly everyone should put the prices up by 10% and secondly that any customers that don't come with you just dump them because they're not worth having anyway.
You're quoting me slightly out of context. But yes, the thinking goes as follows. As an independent business, you simply can't compete on price because there's always someone bigger, with better buying power, with deeper pockets, with better salespeople, with better websites, with better sales force. So you can't compete on price, and competing on price is probably a mug's game, and I'll explain why very briefly. If you put your prices up, you send a message out to the market that you feel quite strong and you're quite proud about your product. If you put your prices up, you will lose customers. There's no two way about it. But the customers you lose are what I describe as the pond life or the scum. And they're the ones who are purely buying on price. They don't really do you any favours. They're the ones who phone you on Saturday morning and complain. The people who stay are the ones who love your product, and they're not buying on price. They're buying on flexibility, friendly, local, high-tech. You're in the high street. You're the first with the technology. They've known you from school or whatever it is. So they're buying for different reasons. And what they're buying for, essentially, is that sense of added value and relationship. So those people almost certainly don't go. I've stood up in front of nearly 10,000 people in the last 18 months and asked the question every time, has anyone put prices up? On average, you know, in the last month or two, normally about 10% of hands go up. Not what, and the next question is, those of you who have put the prices up, has it damaged your business? And no one to date has put their hands up and say they've put up their prices and it's damaged their business. Mm. Now, that doesn't mean, it's like nomads and wanderers. All nomads are wanderers and all wanderers are nomads. It doesn't mean that if you put your prices up, you're okay. What it says is, those businesses that feel confident enough in their favourite customers and feel confident in those relationships, when they do put up their prices, they only need to sell less stuff to stay in the same spot, and they do lose business. And if they lose business, it's the business that they kind of didn't want in the first place.
Mm-hmm. And you go into this in some detail in your new book, which I'm about three-quarters of the way through, Bright Marketing.
Yeah.
It's a very practical book, Robert. It's not just about business theory. It's almost like a workbook, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, it's the book that I wanted to buy.
So you wrote it.
So I had to write it, if that kind of makes sense. I'm not a great fan of business school theory and hyperbole and all that kind of stuff. I kind of want stuff that I can read and go, okay, I get it. I can do that in my business. I run a business right now. I'm working from my office right now. I've been running businesses since I was 21. I've been rich. I've been poor. I know which one I prefer. So I've made all the mistakes. I've got the spears in my back, and I think that sort of shows in the book.
And if people want to find out more about the book in the Director's Centre, the website address is?
The website address is directorscentre.com, all spelt English and as you'd expect. So it's directorscentre.com, and do click in and have a look at what we do.
Well, it's been very, very enjoyable and interesting talking to you to you, Robert, this morning. Thanks for joining us.
And pleasure.
Hopefully we'll see you up in the Northwest again very shortly.
Oh, yes.
Thanks very much.
Great. Thank you very much indeed.
Thanks.
Bye.
That was Robert Craven from the Director's Centre, author of new book Bright Marketing. Highly recommended for those of you who are looking to be perhaps a little bit more off the wall and innovative in your business marketing strategies. I'll be back with my studio guest right after this break.
Downtown Liverpool in business with Frank McKenna. City Talk 105.9.
Well, welcome back to the show. We've just been talking to Robert Craven about Bright Marketing and how one of the things he's suggesting is putting prices up to your customers by 10% and dumping those who don't come with you. It's a bit more sophisticated than that, to be fair to him, but we've also got Paul Rice from the Liverpool District Commercial Partnership with us today. Paul, what's your view on that? Do you think the members at the Commercial Partnership would take kindly to their suppliers saying, well, we're putting our prices up 10%, but the quality of what we're providing is top-notch, so you don't have to look elsewhere?
Well, as you say, it's not generic, Frank, is it? I think there are certain circumstances where that may well be the case. You know, everybody's facing pressures, and if you can be sure, because of the sort of relationships that you have in place, that you could get that service and that price is worth paying, then I think, yes, people would. I think if you look on the other side in terms of the supply of property, that would be suicide for the owners to start putting those sort of principles into place.
Yeah, so it's sector sensitive as well, I guess.
Yeah, very
it?
Much so.
And in the property game at the moment, I mean, people are still struggling, having a tough time. Is that your experience? Because I know a lot of the guys you deal with are in the property game.
There's no question. And, you know, in terms of chasing the few requirements that are out there at the minute, you know, there's it's very, very competitive. There's a lot of space there to be filled. And indeed, even those customers you have got, your ability to retain them and to provide the right deal at the right price is a skill as well.
Mm. Dougal, what was your take on that last point that that Robert was making?
I think it's a fair one, and I think if your business has the right depth of relationship with a client and you can justify how you're going to add further value to them, then great. I don't think I would go in with a bald, here's 10% pay rise, do you love me or not? Mm. I think I would go in and sell it off the back of further value added as part of that process.
Mm-hmm. Brian, you were saying that, you know, you've obviously been right at the centre of the shift in terms mm-hmm. of people's marketing strategies and yep. the way in which we actually behave now, mm-hmm. our culture of buying.
Yep.
I think everyone, you know, goes online now, don't they, and checks out what's being mm-hmm. sold. If you need a new television, a new car, whatever it is almost, you yep. go online and compare and contrast. But that customer relations thing mm-hmm. is still vitally important. And I think what Robert was saying was, you know, if you've got those sort of quality relationships, you can often find that you will actually get more money from those customers that are satisfied that you've got great relationships yeah. with, rather than sticking at the price you've got mm-hmm. and continuing to try and service customers that perhaps yeah. don't quite get the product that you're selling mm-hmm. or appreciate what you're doing for them.
Yeah, absolutely. I think everybody will be, any business owner will be nodding their head along with, you know, we've all got A, B, C and D clients. You know, that's just part and parcel of business. I think Robert's making a few assumptions there, and obviously he's trying to cram a lot into a few minutes. I think putting your prices up is one way to get rid of the smaller clients. But I think, how about putting the value of what you do up 10%, you know, following from what Dougal's just saying there. And I think that's what differentiates success online. You've got to differentiate yourself and offer a better service. There is no hiding places online. If you can't provide what somebody's looking for, you know, you've got a few vital seconds to, you know, demonstrate you can. And if you can't, they'll be off and they'll be somewhere else. Yeah. You know, so I think that the key things to remember there is, it's okay to be expensive, but it's not cost focused. You've got to focus on the value of what you're offering to your customers.
Mm. And I know, Dougal, because you recommended the book to me, Purple Cow by Seth Godin. I mean, I was absolutely fascinated when I read that book. I picked up so many great tips in terms of just within our business, how you can actually progress and go forward. And it doesn't have to cost a fortune, does it?
No. And Seth makes the point that it's very easy to differentiate yourself from the competition. And as you read the book and as you see the case studies that he offers, that becomes self-evident. The most simple things can make you stand out and make you remarkable. Mm. And he talks about being remarkable in the true sense of the word, as in giving people cause to remark about you and remark positively about you. And it's a cracking read. And if you don't walk away with 15 or two dozen great ideas that you can apply to your business, then I'd be surprised.
Yeah, I agree. I think I would highly recommend both of those books. And there are many business publications out there, of course, but I like those publications that actually do give you some practical advice and practical tips. A bit like Robert was saying, the theory side of things tends to send me asleep, I'm afraid.
That's right. I'm a fan of audiobooks, and I think the reason for that is I am time poor. Yeah. And I think those books out there, that just a few nuggets of great advice that you can pick up and quickly absorb, you know, that's what we need. And I think, you know, I have read Robert's book, and it's definitely got a few gems in there. It's along the same lines as Purple Cow, and, you know, the typical business owner will glean some good nuggets from it. You know, it's well worth a read.
Mm. I think one of the things that marks successful businesses out from those who are also RANs is this issue of state of mind. Successful businesses look under every stone to see what they can find to help them succeed. Yeah. And it is remarkable in every single market out there how many relatively poor quality suppliers there are. If you've got the intellectual hunger and curiosity and energy and dynamism, it actually isn't that hard to get ahead of the pack in relative terms, in my experience.
No, that's right. And I think this R-word recession, you know, basically it's a kick up the arse for a lot of business owners. And it's, you know, if you've been resting on your laurels, you've got to do things a little bit differently. You know, you've got to inject a bit more creativity into your business. And what it does is creates opportunity. And I think if you remove the label recession And you look at it like, if you were lucky enough to wake up tomorrow and all of your competition stopped marketing a little bit harder, and you know a lot of businesses are cutting back, what an opportunity does that present to you? So now's the time to seize those opportunities and get out there and market more, you know, to grow your business. You know, and I'm seeing it more and more with those A clients, if you like, and not the the pond life, as Robert refers to, that are cutting back on the marketing. They're the ones seizing the opportunities and growing the business.
Now, if Liverpool was a business, Paul, particularly with your hat on in the commercial district, do you feel as a city we market ourselves as well as we might? Do we stand out? Are we distinctive? If you like, are we the purple cow of cities in the UK?
I wouldn't say we were the purple cow. What I would say is we are dramatically better than where we were 5 years ago. I think that the whole step change towards, you know, not being shy to use the name Liverpool instead of this strange bureaucratic M-word Merseyside is a step in the right direction. And that's partly, to be fair, that's partly the other part of the city region, having the confidence in Liverpool to be used as an attack brand. I mean, as you know, Frank, I spent a lot of time working in Manchester. And the big difference between Manchester and Liverpool, in my experience from a marketing point of view, was that Manchester was such a compelling proposition that the Wiggins and Rochdales would have been absolutely crazy not to have jumped on board. And I don't think Liverpool has always offered that to its neighbours. I think it does now. I think the fantastic work that's been done, particularly in the city centre, Speke Garston, the other gateways, have really shown the way, and there's much more confidence now in the idea of Liverpool being that attack brand. I think the brand itself is fantastic, and we have to make sure we use it. And you know, next week we'll be at MIPIM. We'll be launching a new push for inward investment into the commercial district in particular, and into Liverpool in general. And it's picking up really on Brian's point. The reason we're doing that is because we know we can go to MIPIM next week. There'll be no time wasters at MIPIM because people can't afford to go for the jolly. They'll be there looking to do business, and hopefully we'll be able to take advantage of that.
I think at one time, and I think this is sort of demonstrates the maturity that Liverpool now has in terms of the sort of initiatives, MIPIM, Shanghai Expo, you think of as well, whereby 5-6 years ago, we would have had screams from all and sundry about why you're going away, wasting money on this foreign jamboree, whilst, you know, our bins are being emptied 3 times a week and so on and so forth, where now there does appear to be a sense of purpose in terms of when the city council and businesses go abroad to market the city. There's an appreciation that actually that's money worth spending. I know, Dougal, you are a MIPIM veteran, I guess. You've been on a number of occasions. And you've always said to me what a fantastic showcase that is for any city that participates. But for Liverpool in particular, I guess, over the past few years, it's a must-attend event, isn't it?
It certainly is. If you sold eggs, and most of the eggs in the world were bought at Eggfest, and Eggfest was in Vancouver, then you would have to go to Vancouver in order to sell your eggs, or you'd have a business. Well, MIPIM is the Eggfest of world cities and destinations. You simply have to be there. If you're not, you lose credibility, you lose opportunity. If I ran Liverpool, would I go to MIPIM? I would go to MIPIM with a budget 10 times higher if I could find it, and do more selling and more marketing.
I was going to ask you about that, actually, because, again, not to get too negative about this, because, as I say, I think Liverpool as a city has improved enormously in terms of the way we market and the confidence that we now have to attend these sort of events. But do you think that there's still a nervousness among our civic leadership that we can't be too glitzy, we can't be too in your face? Because for me, you know, I think that we should have the absolute best stand exhibition, the best people there. And last year, for example, Warren Bradley felt he couldn't attend because of the political pressure and the potential criticism he was going to get. Now, I said this to Warren, and I'll repeat it. I think that was a mistake. I think your best people have got to be at that event meeting, let's face it, some of the biggest inward investors that you could potentially come across.
Yeah, it's about leadership, isn't it? And it's about justifying what's right And sometimes what's right isn't necessarily what's popular. Mm. But I'm not a politician and I'm not reliant on people's votes, so that's easy for me to say. Were I would stand up and say, we have to be here. We have to be here in the best possible shape that we can afford. We have to work hard at offering value to our private sector partners who fund a lot of this, because let's remember that much of MIPIM and much of Shanghai isn't funded from the public purse. There are commercial businesses who see the opportunities that both those events offer and are putting serious money behind them. So back to the point Brian and I made earlier, you have to offer more value, and Liverpool's tried very hard this year to do that. The nature of the programme is much more distinctive, it's quite different, there's much more partnership there, much more opportunity for Liverpool cheerleaders to get stuck in. I think, however, that there's no doubt that we will remain at MIPIM. I think politicians of all hues understand its value, understand why we need to be there.
How have the property sector reacted to MIPIM this year? Have we been able to sustain the sort of support that we've enjoyed in the past, not just in terms of the financial contribution they've made, but in terms of the number of people, cheerleaders, as Dougal's, I think, rightly described them as, going across to France and actually ensuring that Liverpool has a strong private sector presence there as well?
I don't think there'll be as many as the heyday as of 2006, 7, 8, where, you know, there were huge delegations per company, let alone per city. But I think that people have been smarter about it, and certainly we know that a lot of the companies who are our members are relying on ourselves and Liverpool Vision, plus TMP and the City Council, to get that message over. There will be some of them going, but not that many. And it's, as I say, it's being smarter about it and making sure that we represent them properly when we were there, which I think is an important thing as well, that we do that. If, as an organisation, we exist to add value for our members. If we're not doing that, then we cease to exist. And that's certainly the reason that I'll be going, and that's why my members have supported the decision for us to have a presence there alongside the city.
Brian, you are a fairly frequent visitor to New York, because you're considerably richer than anyone else in the studio. But again, Liverpool's reputation... You see, I always contend that Liverpool's reputation in the UK is not as good as it should be. But internationally, it's absolutely fantastic. And I guess you get that sort of reaction when you go to New York. You mention Liverpool, and it's instantly recognisable, isn't it, as a brand?
Absolutely. I don't think the people of Liverpool appreciate what we have as a brand, and certainly on the other side of the pond there. I've seen over a number of short years, you mentioned Liverpool, and it used to be, that's that place where the Beatles were from. And now it is recognised, you know, with the capital of culture and that kind of thing. It's recognised as a serious global city, you know, and I think we've got to be proud of that. And I think that's born out of the sheer fact that private sector, you know, business owners in Liverpool have got that entrepreneurial spirit, and they're the ones driving it forward, and, you know, long may it continue.
I mean, Dougal spoke at an event for us recently at downtown Liverpool, and somebody asked the question, where should Liverpool's head office be? And I thought your answer was superb, if you want to repeat it.
Yeah, it should be where our potential customers are. Liverpool's head office should be probably in three places, Shanghai, Mumbai and Dubai, to be honest. And if not, goodbye.
But I think, again, you know, if you looked at that proposition, as a politician, you might think, that's an expensive option. But the buy-in that you would get, and I would suggest New York as well, to be honest with you, because I think we've got so many links with that particular city that we don't necessarily take as much advantage of. Yeah. But again, you know, Shanghai wouldn't dream of inviting Manchester to that expo. You know, they feel that outside of London, Liverpool is the big city, Paul.
I think that's right, and I think it's interesting. You know, Manchester muscles its way in. You know, it goes back to Victorian times, the gentlemen of Liverpool and the men of Manchester, and you know, they're not afraid to be the men of Manchester and get themselves in front of people. Howard not long ago hosted a dinner on Wall Street, key decision makers. You know, we should be doing exactly the same thing, or doing it before them and not copying Manchester. And we've got to exploit that brand. I think as well, on a positive side, one of the points Robert made was about SMEs and the poor me victim attitude. I think that's something we suffered from a long time, that grant dependency approach. Oh, we can't do it without a grant, not in Liverpool approach. And I think that has gone. It is much more can do these days. And I think we need to reinforce that. And it's just the point that Brian makes. You know, this is a good story we've got to tell here, actually. We don't have to go defensively saying, oh, well, yeah, you know, there are problems. But we can actually go out with that attack brand and say, this is a fantastic place to be. And to quote the Shanghai theme, you know, better life, better city.
Mm. Do we think there's a consistency of approach to the way in which we promote and market Liverpool? I'm thinking that we've got several agencies now involved in that activity. You've got from the North West Development Agency, the City Council, Vision, the Mersey Partnership. Do you think we know what we're selling at the moment?
I think they understand their respective roles. There's concordats between each organisation. They know where they must act. If there's an issue from where I sit, it's about salesmanship. Mm. I sat around a table the other day with a guy who was involved with Belfast in successfully attracting the New York Stock Exchange to bring much of its back-end work into Belfast. And he said that his biggest competitor was Howard Bernstein. And Howard Bernstein understood the importance of very visible civic salesmanship. I'm the boss of Manchester, I'd like you in my parish. Belfast won it because their politicians are more senior. Northern Ireland's a country, Manchester's a city, and that helped sway it. But Belfast took the same approach. The boss guy in Belfast picked up the phone, spoke to the guys in the New York Stock Exchange, said, we want you in our city. And I've said this before, I've published papers on this subject. I think civic salesmanship is vital, and we haven't done that in Liverpool. We don't have our civic leaders ringing the phone up saying, I run this parish, I can help you, talk to me. Mm. That's how I sell my business. Mm. Mm.
And Paul, you said before you spent a considerable amount of time in Manchester. Was it noticeably different in terms of the way the politicians act and behave there?
Not so much the politicians. I think...
I should distinguish, actually, Sir Howard is the chief executive of Manchester City Absolutely. Council. He's not a politician at all.
But the politicians... The
he'd have made a good one, then.
He certainly would. The politicians tended to keep it in the council chamber. It didn't seem to be in the Manchester Evening News day in, day out. I mean, I welcome the comments at the leaders' debate last week about, you know, not let Liverpool sink back into petty politics. You know, I think we, as businesses, we should hold them to account going forward on that. But, you know, Richard Leeson and Howard have been there for a long time. I think that's forgotten sometimes. And they work together hand in glove for a long time and form a really formidable leadership. But they understand exactly what Dougal's just said, that there is their civic responsibility to go out. Because if they don't do it, who else is going to do it? Yeah. And then people, Colin Sinclair, who's now gone to Bruntwood, who was at Midas, Drew Stokes at Marketing Manchester, they understand where they are in the pecking order. Yeah. And I think that's part of the problem, because there's this jockeying for position sometimes at the top. We've not had that solidity and consistency at the top that Manchester had. Hopefully that's beginning to change and not before time.
Mm. A clearer structure, I suppose, is what you're saying, yeah. Paul, is to know who is responsible for what and where the politicians actually need to get involved, because you don't necessarily require your council leader or chief executive to be involved at the start of a process, but by the end of it, that could be the very thing that, as we were all talking about earlier, adds a bit of value and says to the customer, we really care. And as you said, Dougal, you wouldn't dream of staying out of a negotiation with a potential big client for your business. And for me, Liverpool as a city has to start to operate in exactly that way.
Yeah, the leader of any business, and Liverpool is a business, is the guarantor of promises made, and the person who most visibly will ensure in the mind of a potential customer that those promises will be kept. And so you do have to have the leadership at some point in the sales process making their presence and their personality felt.
Mm. And of course, one of the big things that we try and sell the city on the back of is that fantastic sport of football. It's not been... A great season for either club, for a variety of reasons, I suppose. I mentioned earlier, Paul, you're involved in the spirit of Shankly, and I know that there's been discussions between yourselves and the Everton fan group Keep Everton in Our City about the potential not to necessarily develop new stadia, but look at the possibilities of regenerating, if you like, the existing Anfield and Goodison Park. Where's that particular debate up to?
We've sent an open letter to the chief executive of Liverpool Football Club, chief executive of Everton, vice-chancellors of the two universities, North West Development Agency, the Mersey Partnership and the City Council, calling on them to conduct a feasibility study into the idea of a football quarter using Stanley Park as the focus and that duopoly of Liverpool and Everton, which is unique to have two teams of such standing, have won so much, have so much history and tradition over the years. And we believe that there's a real opportunity to build on that, using the two stadiums as anchors with other facilities in the park, educational facilities, other sports facilities, and most importantly, community facilities, because if anywhere in Liverpool has been let down over recent years, it is the communities in North Liverpool, and that whole uncertainty that has stalled, in my opinion, the housing market renewal initiative in the Liverpool Four area because of what's happening with the two football clubs. And we believe that that's the way that we should go. I don't think it's good enough for the civic leadership, again, to sit back and say, oh, well, it's up to the two football clubs, it's been, you know, after you, Claude. And neither should the two football clubs sit back and say, no, it can't be done. They're on a different journey. Everton have come to a dead end and have had to start again. Mm-hmm. Liverpool got so far and then stalled with the park because of the soap opera that is the ownership. But they do still have that planning permission for the park. So it's a question of whether you can align those things and actually bring it all together. And that's why it requires, we believe, some civic leadership and that broader public sector input to make it work, to share some of the costs of the transport infrastructure, etc., to actually move the whole process forward. I think the biggest indictment really is if we look back to 1992 and the advent of the Premier League, if you look where Everton and Liverpool were, particularly Liverpool at that point, and you look at where Manchester United, Chelsea, Arsenal were, the complacency and mismanagement of the two clubs borders on the criminal. And that's forgetting about what Hicks and Gillette may have done at Anfield in recent years. The fact is there's been a series of missed opportunities for the two clubs. And what we're saying as fans now is we would support you, and we believe the broader community would support you, to put all that behind you and come up with a solution that is the right thing for the city.
What's the football clubs, both of them, what have the reaction been to this particular proposal? Because I know both chief executives were at a meeting recently where this item was discussed.
Unfortunately, we weren't invited to that meeting for whatever reason. We had had a meeting with the leader of the council and with Tom Cannon from the university. For reasons best known to them, they didn't invite us when they called the football clubs in, which is obviously their prerogative. We understand that the position of the chief executives is it's not doable. Well, how they can come to that conclusion, I'm not quite sure, because we're not saying it can be done. We're saying, look, we think this is a good idea. We think it would gain popular support. Let's make a relatively small investment that could actually do something really big for the city and actually save the two football clubs a lot of money in the process.
Mm. I mean, again, I think the point that you made back in the early 90s and certainly in the mid-80s, this was the premier city as far as football was concerned. And it doesn't take a genius to recognise that both clubs are in decline at the moment. I mean, if Liverpool fail to qualify for the Champions League, I guess in a financial sense alone, that's going to have a dramatic effect and impact on what they do next season in the transfer market and so on and so forth. The statistics released recently about the finances of football showed that Manchester United on a match day alone earned something in the region of 60,000 pounds a game. No, it must be about 100 million pounds a match day or something, Manchester United take in comparison to Liverpool's 40 million. So it's a massive, massive gap, isn't it, in terms of what those clubs are generating at the moment. And again, you know, two things, I suppose. Dougal, do you think that the football clubs have worked hard enough to promote and market themselves? And do you think the city has actually celebrated football as best as it might?
I think the football clubs will tell you that within their business plan, they're happy with how they're performing. If you look at their continually rising income, they'll tell you that they're happy with that. They would want more, of course. I think there's a hard reality that we as fans and business people need to realise here. The football club are owned. The football clubs are owned by small groups of shareholders. Yeah. It's their business. We can talk about it as a community asset, but the legal reality is it's an asset owned by a small group of individuals, and it's their asset to do with, subject to law and planning and everything else, as they please. They own it, not us. Now, that's a very hard and unpalatable truth, and there's a philosophical debate to be had about their role in the community and so on. But I think we have to recognise that there is... Liverpool and Everton football clubs are free to act as they see fit in the interests of their company, under company law and everything else. And if they don't want to do something, they don't have to. And that's a potential weakness in any broader argument and any broader political engagements. You're in the hands, particularly in the case of Liverpool, of some very, very experienced and very savvy investors who, as a betting man, I would suggest, well, suspect probably won't be around for too long, but when they go, it'll be of a timing that suits them and for a price and value that suits them.
On their terms.
On their terms, absolutely. Mm. So that's a hard reality that some people need to adjust to, I think. Mm. I mean, Paul will have a view on that, of course.
Yeah, I think there's two things on that. I think the first is, and we've spent a lot of time on this programme today talking about customers and the balance of power shifting to customers. And I think that sometimes the football clubs forget that we're customers. They treat us like turnstile fodder, to use the old term. And if people stop coming, then those football clubs go. The reality is that Liverpool in particular, and Everton, will not make the progress that they need to make with those businesses, staying in the same stadiums they are, with the current level of investments in those two clubs. And the customers are telling them that they don't like what they're doing, whether that's moving to Kirby, not actually moving forward with the stadium in Liverpool's case. So I think that, you know, we have to bear that in mind when we talk about where they go as a business. I think you mentioned, Frank, where Liverpool and not being in the Champions League. I think the situation with Liverpool, even more than not being in the Champions League, is without the immediate investment, the impact that has on them paying down the debt, the impact that has on them retaining players, never mind getting new players, is absolutely critical. And I think if we don't see some movement in that investment in the next few months, Christian Paisley keeps telling us is going to happen, then I think Liverpool have got serious, serious problems, far worse than we've seen so far. Mm. I can only hope that we can take him at his word, and over the next month or two, we will see some movement on that investment. Mm.
I found it strange that Manchester United have been able to mobilise the sort of fan base and the demonstrations when the top of the league, they've just won the Carling Cup and they're still in the Champions League. But there you go. I suppose the expectations down the M62... these days a little bit higher than ours, which is a shame. But no doubt, as with politics, business, football goes in cycles, and we can only hope that a return to the mid-80s is just around the corner for both Liverpool and Everton football clubs. That's it from me, Frank McKenna, and City Talks Business. Thanks to my guests this week, Dougal Paver of Paver Smith, Brian Adams from PH Creative, Paul Rice from the Liverpool District Commercial Partnership, and Robert Craven. And thank you for listening. Have a great week, and don't do anything I wouldn't do.
Downtown Liverpool in business with Frank McKenna. City Talk 105.9. City Talk 105.9. Official podcasts. Online at citytalk.fm.